Welcome to the Friends with Money podcast, brought to you by Money Magazine, creating financial freedom for Australians since 1999.
Welcome to the Friends with Money podcast, your weekly pod to help you save and make more money. My name is Michelle Baltazar. I'm the editor-in-chief here at Money Magazine. Thank you for joining us. Today, we have a very special guest who's going to chat to us about all things about investing from the other side of the world. He is the founder of the award-winning fund manager Fisher Investments and has done an incredible job building his own fortune to the tune of more than $6 billion, or just under 10 billion in Aussie dollars. But despite his many accomplishments and commitments, he devotes quite a bit of time sharing his wisdom and knowledge through his YouTube channel, for example, on the Fisher Investments YouTube channel, and through his regular column in the Daily Telegraph in the UK. So I must say that's probably the longest introduction I've done on a podcast, but it's worth acknowledging what I think is this immense sharing of investment expertise with us today. So please welcome on this podcast, Ken Fisher. Ken, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Michelle. It's my pleasure and an honor.
Thank you. Now, I think our listeners are going to really benefit from this interview, because the big question is always, how do you build wealth? And more importantly, how do you do it in such a way that you're also protecting your existing income or wealth? Because as you know, we live in a world where there are so many investment scams, so many get-rich-quick kind of schemes. And so I am just so absolutely delighted that you're here with us to talk about this. Now, let's go back to your early days. And as an investor, can you share with us what was the first stock you made money on? And how did you go about building your wealth?
What I learned was that my real world knowledge, because I'd done construction during college and what have you, and I thought I knew about home building and things like that, investing in a land developer home builder, knowing that stuff doesn't really apply. You really have to know the inside and guts of a business, not just the nature of the industry in a general sense. The nature of the market is you got to know something other people don't know. That's the fundamental feature of how you actually prevail beyond luck. The first stock that I ever actually did really well with was a couple of years later, which was PPG Industries, mm-hmm. Which was at the time America's largest glass producer, second largest chlorine producer, second largest paint producer, and maker of continuous strand fiberglass. It was in the 1974 bear market, and you could just buy somebody that was number one or two in four major categories and was good in all of them at four times depressed earnings. You can't beat that. The reality is, the way to think about that is, if it's four times earnings, divide one by four, and assuming that the earnings are real, you got a 25% rate of return on your investment. You don't need a whole lot more than that if it's real.
And is this something that has been the guiding principle for you, where it's kind of the metric or the benchmark that you look at?
No, not at all. The reality is there is no one benchmark. There is no one metric. There just isn't. Mm. It was a starting point, and sometimes that's a great starting point, but there's a lot of other things that fit into the world. Sometimes low PE works. A lot of times it doesn't. I mean, it doesn't when value investing is popular, because the reality is you want to buy what's not popular. When value investing is what everybody wants to do, value investing tends not to work. My biggest original fame came when I developed what's now the widely known, I mean, I did this in the late 70s, what's now the widely known price sales ratio. I'm very proud that I developed a price sales ratio, the first writings you can find on it anywhere of mine. And the reality is there's a time when it works too and doesn't, both low and high. There's a time for this and there's a time for that, and there is no one thing that works all the time.
So it's a case of really using the right metric for one type of investment or one season of investing rather than a specific one. So, for example, it's amazing that literally you're the father of the price to sales ratio, but people talk about the PE ratio, the free cash flow, and now we've got tech stocks as well and how you measure their success or future success.
Yep. And all of that's true. And there's a time for all of that. And there's also a time when those same things don't work well at all.
I'm in absolute awe of your financial success. In Australia, you probably know this, the average price of a house now is around $1 million. So technically, everyone's a millionaire, but we're still struggling with cost of living expenses and all these challenges. So tell us, I'm really curious, what's that kind of inflection point where you feel like, I'm financially comfortable now, and perhaps no such thing as like serious financial struggles in the future?
So I wish I had a good answer for you, Michelle, but I don't. Let me put it this way. The reality is you can have way more money than you'll ever need in your life and still not be convinced of it. Whereas other people are very secure. Now, mind you, I think your point's well taken. Few people are highly confident if they're 50 years old and they've got is a million Aussie dollars and that's all in their house. They're not very confident about their future. So, but maybe they are, because maybe they're more secure. You know, I just don't know that you can make rules about that. One of the things you can say about self-made billionaires, mm-hmm. as opposed to inherited billionaires, is self-made billionaires know how they did it. And then the question is that I think distinguishes within them, do they stick to that? Or do now they think they're a genius and they can go off do a whole bunch of other stuff and they're probably not all that great at all at other stuff. You follow that? Mm. But being a great athlete in one sport doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be a great athlete in another sport or a pop singer.
So say, for example, just kind of narrowing it down to someone's finances and an average household, there's always like this idea that you're worried. What keeps you awake at night is, how do I cover school expenses? How do I afford my mortgage repayments? What are the worries? Like, what keeps you awake at night?
I've been doing markets all my life, so market volatility doesn't mean much to me. In terms of bothering me the way it bothers some people. And that's where you have to get to, is where the volatility of things and the fear. You know, one of the things that I heard when I was young that I always thought was useful is, do you think a good battlefield general, having done all the prep necessary for the battle the next day, has trouble going to sleep the night before the battle? And if he can't sleep the night before the battle, he's doing his or her soldiers disservice. You follow that? Because he needs to be rested the next day for the battle to be at his best for them. And the reality is, you just got to get to where you learn not to let these things bother you. You made the point about, you know, what effectively is budgeting correctly relative to what you've got and what you can afford to spend. Mm. And that is really important when you don't have a lot. But once you get past that threshold, then the issue is figuring out what you really know that works, that you can invest in, not fads and fancies and not the latest thing to come along and hot new stuff, but what you really understand, and do it, and then not let distractions bother you.
I like that. In fact, I enjoyed reading your latest article on the Daily Telly about inflation has been vanquished. That's what we want to hear. We just want to kind of have some guidance on figuring out what to do next. But here in Australia, there's this kind of obsession in the investment community around after-tax returns and tax optimization strategies. What do you think of that?
Well, first, after-tax returns are the only returns that really matter, because if it's not after-tax, it's not really yours. So the reality is that is the case. On the other hand, it is usually a mistake to put tax minimization ahead of the return function, because there's all kinds of ways to not pay tax and not come out ahead. And there's all kind of rat holes you can go down in that regard. Just the blessings of a superannuitization fund in terms of tax. Mm-hmm. What you really want is to aim yourself at investments that you don't really have to realize a lot of tax in, but still get you a good return. That takes you away from most fixed income. It takes you away from pretty much all the really easy stuff and puts you into a world where there is more volatility or less liquidity. And then once you do that, you got to know what you're doing.
Yes.
The easiest one is just to be a passive equity owner and diversify. You know, that's actually pretty tax efficient. It doesn't take a genius. It takes self-restraint so you don't sell every time there's bad news in the media, right? And you don't sell when you think something's going to be really terrible, but you're not really an expert in that topic.
Mm.
I was never the smartest guy in the world. I knew that growing up in school. I was always a good kid, relatively smart, hardworking. But the reality is, in the marketplace, it's not about being the smartest. It's about knowing what you're doing. And a lot of the people that are the smartest actually don't know what they're doing because they're so smart that they think they can do anything.
I really like that. I think you've kind of simplified it, but you've hit it on the nail with superannuation, where it is a very, you know, tax-friendly environment with only 15% versus the average 30% on personal tax. If you only have $100,000 to invest, how would you invest it? How would you recommend someone invest that kind of money?
If I only had $100,000, what I'd do is put it passively into the stock market until I'd read at least 40 investment books. In my first year as a professional investor, I went in a world before the internet, of course, mm-hmm. long before the internet, 1972. I went into the library and I got book after book after book, investment books. I read articles on what are the top books to read, but I went beyond the new and contemporary. I read the new and contemporary. I read the old ones. And the reality is you can learn a lot by reading. And when it comes to investing, you learn a lot more if you read 40 top investment books than you would ever in some kind of a graduate investment course or MBA in a university. And it's only after that that I'd start to do anything other than the passive investment.
I love it. I think that's going to be my New Year's resolution. I'm very fortunate to have come across so many investment books. That's a pretty good tip. Invest passively until you've kind of devoured as many investment books as you can. And for Ken, it's 40. 40 is the number. Here in Australia, the consensus is a recession next year, more tough times ahead. So what would you say to our listeners who are thinking, I'm a new investor, it's probably next year that I'll invest for the first time? How would you invest when there's like this forecast of a recession or tougher times in the economy?
You know, I not only write in the Daily Telegraph, but I write in the New York Post online, not behind a paywall. I also write in the Australian, all these in English. I write in the National, which is, again, not behind a paywall. Most Australians wouldn't know about the National, but it's the second biggest paper in the Middle East, spanning MENA, and the largest English-speaking paper in MENA. But what you're going to see as this year progresses, in column after column this month, is I'm going to be telling people it's going to be a pretty good year. U.S. presidential election years have been positive in 83% of history. When the second year has been negative, like 2022 was, presidential election year in America has been positive every single time since 1932. once we get the bejabbers scared out of us in a bear market, it takes a couple of years to get past that. When a bull market hits 1 year of age, it almost always makes a second. The fact of the matter is, we started 2023 thinking the same things you're talking about now: recession, bad times, tough times ahead. Everybody thought that. They were wrong then. They're going to be wrong this time. The consensus is always wrong. John Templeton famously said, legendary investor, he legendarily said, bull markets are born on pessimism, grow on skepticism, mature on optimism, and die on euphoria. And the fact is, when you've got a very skeptical world, bull markets still run. That doesn't mean there won't be corrections like we had last year. It doesn't mean there won't be corrections, maybe even a couple of corrections. But when skepticism is that high and bull market's a year old, and particularly in a presidential election, your correlation between Australian stocks and U.S. stocks is positive. It's pretty high. And depending on what time period you look at in history. And the problem with variance is with Australian stocks versus U.S. stocks, as you know, is the overweight and dependence on Australia in banking and natural resources.
That's right.
But that's another reason why Australians should think global, both about markets and about the economy, not just about Australia itself.
Well, I definitely like the idea of just going with contrarian thinking. Like you said, when the market consensus is one way, it's most likely that it's going to go the other way. Just to recap again on what you said, the power of after-tax returns, looking at educating yourself, making sure that you read as many investment books as you can before you start actively investing, and really looking at passive investing or going to the experts for that. And finally, think globally. I know that a lot of our listeners understand that we are top-heavy on banking and resources, and there's nothing better than diversification and also just ignoring the market noise, or as Ken said, the market consensus. Once again, it's a pleasure to have you, Ken. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Michelle. It was fun.
No dramas. Before we go, don't forget that if you enjoy listening to the Friends with Money podcast, we'd love for you to recommend it to your own friends and family, or you can help us out by leaving a review on iTunes or the Apple podcast app. And don't forget to check out the Fisher Investments YouTube channel. I was watching the last six episodes, and really fantastic and amazing sharing of wisdom from Ken there. You can also send in any questions, comments, or even topics you'd love for us to cover on our dedicated email, which is podcast@moneymag.com.au. And finally, make sure you head over to moneymag.com.au for all the latest financial news and stories. That's it for this episode. I'm Michelle Baltazar. Bye for now.
Thanks for listening to the Friends with Money podcast. For credible, independent, and easy to understand financial commentary, visit moneymag.com.au. Please remember that the views and opinions expressed in this podcast are general in nature, and further independent advice and research based on your personal circumstances should be sought before making an investment decision.